Welcome to Who's Talking Today. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Ernest Dollar, who is the executive director of the Orange County Historical Museum, and who is very interested in the events that accompany the end of the Civil War in April of 1865 in this area, in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area, leading up to the surrender at Bennett Place later on in April. Ernest, thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Just by way of background, there are two things I'd like to mention. One is that you're stepping down as the executive director of the museum, and you have a successor coming in at the end of September. And her name is Jennifer
Coach.
Coach, who will be taking over your position. And what are you going to be doing?
Well, I'm going to start my new profession as dad. I'll be having a baby the first week in October, and I'll be going back to school to try and get my master's degree in museum studies from UNC Greensboro.
So, you'll be a dad, a commuting dad, back and forth to school. I don't want to get too far off topic, but I'm real curious about the museum program at UNC Greensboro and what attracted you there and what would you be doing there?
Well, I owe it all to working at the museum in Hillsboro. It was one of the most difficult jobs I think ever had, but again, one of the most rewarding jobs. So it kind of set me on a career path, and I looked around at trying to further my education in museums. And between Raleigh had a good public history program, but UNCG had more of a concentrated museum studies program. I guess they developed in 1996. So
this, which would include museums of all for art, science, history, and other kinds of museums, rather than just focusing on history.
Right.
So you've learned what you need to know, and now you're going to learn that it's not just being a history scholar. You've got to be fundraiser, carpenter.
Janitor.
Yeah, everything else. Well, we might get back to that. The second thing that I'd like for you to share with the folks who are listening, and really one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you at this particular moment in time, is that the history group and the museum and Hillsboro, everyone's sponsoring a wonderful seminar this weekend, a symposium, I guess you call it, this weekend. And it's going to be tell us about what's going on. It's about the end of the Civil War, about the Civil War.
Right, sort of Orange County's role in the Civil War. Probably your listeners will recognize Freddie Kiger. Be speaking.
I think everybody at WCHL will recognize Freddie Kiger.
I have not heard Freddie, but I heard he is an excellent orator.
There's no doubt about that. Very well informed and enthusiastic and entertaining speaker. So, yeah, people, you will, and he has a great crowd of people who will go anywhere, like the Grateful Dead. His fans will follow him anywhere.
So he'll be speaking about Orange County soldiers fighting at the Battle of Sharpsburg, which is in northern Maryland, and it's the anniversary on the 17th, so he thought it was a nice tie-in to Orange County. We have a speaker named Jacqueline Campbell, who's just come out a new book on women and African Americans' resistance to Sherman's March, sort of how they played a role in that. And I guess I'll be speaking on the Battle of New Hope Creek. I constantly get people coming to the museum and sending me emails wanting to know about this infamous, if not mythological, battle fought on the outskirts of Chapel Hill.
Well, I just hate for you to use the word mythological because this is one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you, because I'm one of those people who keep hearing about these rumblings that the last real exchange of fire, the battle, I guess, or skirmish before the surrender of General Johnson at Bennett Place took place right within, you know, within walking distance of Chapel Hill. And that's why I want you to explain this. Now, if you just come up and say this is a myth, it's going to be a big disappointment.
It's not. The reason I say it's mythological is that it is. It's sort of like almost like a legend in local lore in Chapel Hill. You had everything from students at UNC writing novels, plays on this mythological battle, but the research, as painstaking as it has been to find, says that they were, if not only one, but several skirmishes right on the New Hope Creek, right outside Chapel Hill.
What just to get the geography in place first, and then we'll go back and get a little bit of the history. These battles were along New Hope Creek, but New Hope Creek runs a long course. And where can you give us neighborhoods or intersections?
Pretty much the route, to sort of set up the battles in New Hope Creek, you have to kind of go back to April 13th of 1865 at Morrisville, which most people know is where the airport is located. Here, not only the Confederate Army under Joseph Johnston splits to try and make a better time escaping General William T. Sherman's advance through the Carolinas. So he splits his army there, taking one half through Durham Station onto Hillsboro, with the other half taking a westerly route, kind of going up through the Carpenter community and up to Chapel Hill to kind of recombine with the army around Hillsboro, if not Greensboro.
The armies then were retreating Western. In two different routes, with the idea that they would join back up again. And
well, Johnston's army was trying to make it to Virginia to link up with Lee, but once they learn of Lee's surrender on April 9th, they're just kind of without a direction. So they just keep following the railroad west to try.
Tell us about this other section of Johnston's forces that were retreating. You said they divided up.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, one wing went north, kind of followed the railroad up through the Research Triangle onto Durham proper and on through Hillsboro. And again, this westernly wing, which is pretty much the one we're going to be focusing on talking about the Battle of New Hope Creek, takes a westernly route out of Morrisville. It goes through the Carpenter community on up 751.
But sort of roughly headed along Highway 54.
If you want to follow the country road, I think it's O'Kelly's Church Road.
Okay.
And if you're not sure, with O'Kelly's Chapel on Highway 751.
And about how many troops were involved in this retreat? Do we know?
Johnston's army at the surrender at Bennett Place, he has about 26,000 soldiers, roughly. So. Again, most of the army that he throws together haphazardly at the end of the war to try and defeat Sherman at Bentonville, all these same soldiers are just marching back through the country.
Well, all right. Well, I guess to get us in a way so we can understand this, you might need to tell us a little bit about how Sherman got to North Carolina and what he did once he got here and how that resulted in the troops kind of meeting here at New Hope Creek.
Well, Sherman gets to North Carolina. It's his campaign, which he considered harder than his march to the sea in 1864. So he moves out of Savannah, cuts a swath through the Carolinas, burning Columbia, and is trying to make a goal to hook up with Grant, who was opposing General Lee outside Petersburg. Once he again learns of Lee surrender in Virginia, he makes a concerted effort to destroy the largest Confederate army operating in the field, which is Johnston's army. And Johnston had the orders to try and stop Sherman. So as they move to the Carolinas, and basically what we're going to see, most of the fighting through central North Carolina is done by cavalry.
Well, what is the – are they coming up from the Wilmington or coming up from Columbia or where –
Sherman makes a beeline toward Goldsboro. After the Battle of Bentonville, he hooks up with a lot of the rail line, which runs from Wilmington up to Goldsboro. You know, Wilmington had fallen early in January of 1865. And so that rail line where he can get supplies, refitted his army, his mail. So he uses that to launch the last campaign on April 10th, which will bring him to Raleigh and to Bennett Place.
Wow. Well, what about the capture of Raleigh, was there a big battle at Raleigh to capture the capital?
Again, I should preface this by saying legend has it. Raleigh was surrendered with only a few shots being fired, and there's such a wonderful part of Raleigh legend that a lone Confederate stood on a road awaiting the approach of the Federal cavalry and lowered his revolver and fired six rounds and turned to flee. And, of course, was captured by Kilpatrick, who was incensed. That he had been assaulted while reclaiming one of the last Confederate state capitals. So this unknown Confederate horseman was hanged on the spot by his aides.
Wow.
That's about the defense of Raleigh.
That was the battle. And so the Federal troops at the time of these skirmishes in Chapel Hill were in control of Raleigh.
Yes.
And they were moving westward, sort of in a discipline, or in a, would you say, in a disciplined way? Or
exactly. And again, what we're looking at through this area is cavalry fighting. So Sherman is trying to actually implement a strategy which he will catch Johnston in Charlotte. Now, how that works is he's sending his cavalry on the direct path following Johnston's retreating army. That is, he's using his cavalry as the scouts to try and press them hard on their retreat.
To make them retreat faster, is that
right.
his idea?
Mm-hmm. Or just to, you know, get to slow down or kind of distract Johnston from moving his troops. You know, if he's worrying about a lot of Federal cavalry.
Oh, I see. So and just the opposite from going faster, if he keeps them harassed, they've got to they've got to deal with their rear guard and worry about fighting, and so they will not move as fast.
Right. But at the same time, once Sherman occupies Raleigh, he starts shifting all of his infantry, the real power of his army, down to like areas Holly Springs, near the area near Sharon Harris, to try and move on a parallel course to race Johnston and meet him at Charlotte and have this last battle.
So that was what their plan was. Now, just backing up a little bit, you did explain that the earlier idea that or the orders that General Johnston had in command of this large body of troops here in North Carolina was to move to Virginia to reinforce Lee. Mm-hmm. When did it change that he was going to go to Charlotte instead of up into Virginia?
Well, once they learn that Lee had surrendered, it takes a couple of days for the news to filter down. And with that force out of the way, Johnston has nowhere really to go. Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, tries to convince Johnston to disband the infantry and keep the cavalry together and wage a guerrilla warfare throughout the South. Most people thought that Johnston was trying to make his way down to Mississippi or the Trans-Mississippi to work with those other Confederate armies which were still operating in the field. So that was Davis's site for the plan. But on conference in Greensboro with the Confederate cabinet, which has escaped from Richmond, Johnston is there, General Beauregard, the second in command, and they all kind of see the senselessness in, you know, promoting this warfare, this guerrilla warfare. So that's how the negotiations at Bennett Place come about.
Well, let's take a I want to pursue that and try to understand what was happening within the Confederate government. And particularly between General Johnston and President Davis. But let's take a quick break, catch our breaths, and then come back and attack that problem. This is D.G. Martin. This is Who's Talking Today, and we're talking today with Ernest Dollar, who's the executive director of the Orange County Historical Museum, who is explaining to us exactly how it happened that some of the last skirmishes of the Civil War were fought right here right here near Chapel Hill. We'll be right back after this short break. Well, welcome back to Who's Talking Today. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Ernest Dollar, the executive director of the Orange County Historical Museum, and we're talking in general about the end of the Civil War as it ended right here in North Carolina. Everybody, well, not everybody, but most of our folks know that General Johnston surrendered his troops to General Sherman at Bennett Place, just right around the corner. And we do have appropriate recognition of that with the reconstruction of the Bennett Place. But what we have not focused on, at least widely, are the actual little battles that took place around Chapel Hill. And Ernest Dollar is explaining some of the background of the battles, and then we're going to get back to talking about specifically what we know about those encounters and what we don't know and what some people have said that we can't prove. But Ernest, you're helping us get the context of this. And in April, things were in great confusion, I guess, in the Confederate government. President Davis wanted to keep the contest going, maybe as a guerrilla warfare, similar to what is going on in Iraq now, with hostilities, notwithstanding the conquest of the South by the Union armies. He felt maybe we could continue guerrilla activities. But that was met with skepticism by his military commanders.
Extreme skepticism.
Can you reconstruct or imagine the conversations that took place between and correspondence that took place between the general and the president of the Confederacy, with the general obligated, I guess, in his mind to follow the directors of his commander-in-chief, but feeling some higher responsibility, I guess, to be reasonable.
Jefferson Davis, as president of the Confederacy, had to sort of believe in the South still having his sights on victory, even in late 1865, just because by the nature of his office. And he's facing a commander who he doesn't really like very much. Johnston and Davis had some bad blood over the years, and Johnston took it as a slight that he was picked at the very end to try and pull together all of these ragtag force through the entire Southeast to try and stop Sherman. And, I thought that Davis had put him in command just to have him surrender.
Well, what I can't help but ask, what was the Davis's attitude towards General Lee and his surrender? Did he take that cheerfully?
No. I think he received it with quite glum news, I could expect. In April 2nd is when the Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, falls, and they evacuate, moving down the rail line to Danville, where he receives a warm reception from the people. And just a mere 50 miles away, arriving in Greensboro, the scene's very different. He's booed.
Is that right? This Jefferson Davis was warmly received in Danville, then goes down to Greensboro, and the North Carolinians
To see Davis. And most people don't know that as he's making his way from Danville to Greensboro, the Union forces are raiding in from this East Tennessee, coming over the mountains. General Stoneman's raid is tearing up Winston-Salem, that area, and he misses Davis by about half an hour, capturing at a rail crossing north of Greensboro.
Well, by the Stoneman group, mm-hmm. So not only are the forces of Sherman closing in on General Johnson and Jefferson Davis from the east, as from the Raleigh area, mm-hmm. but across the mountains from this East Tennessee federal stronghold, Stoneman, is this a cavalry group? Or are they?
Yeah, it's basically like a heavy raid, I would expect. Basically mm-hmm. a lot of cavalry soldiers who can move fast, tear up tracks, basically disrupt a lot of the government in North Carolina.
And as far as they're concerned, the war's not over.
Oh, no. They're having a lot of fun tearing up things, I guess.
All this takes us back to General Johnson, who is really preparing to surrender, I guess. He's trying to work out the best surrender terms, but nevertheless, his armies are having to fight the Federals.
And again, if you get into the mind of a Confederate soldier late in 1865, I think many of them knew that their cause was gone, it was extinguished. But I don't think they could allow themselves to believe that. Because I really don't think that they could put their lives on the line day by day without still believing in the cause. That's sort of one of the last things that had motivated them. Most of these soldiers hadn't been paid in over a year, were drawing horrible rations from the government, if they even drew rations at all. Most of them were foraging on the countryside, taking chickens, pigs from farms they approached. So, again, the only thing that these men had left was their still belief in their cause.
Well, let's go back to this area again, and kind of you had pointed out that the Chapel Hill skirmishes followed a fairly big encounter between the federal troops and the Confederate troops in Morrisville. These were Sherman's troops moving westward in pursuit of the retreating Confederate Army. And what happened in Morrisville and why?
Well, again, to look at Morrisville, we have to pick up our story from that lone Texas gunman who attempted to kill the Sherman's cavalry commander as they approached Raleigh. That was April 13th of 1865. The day before, the Federal troops had learned Lee had surrendered. Sherman had told his cavalry commander, whatever it takes to crush Johnston's army. There's no more taking cities or anything. The only thing left is to crush Johnston's army. So he basically lets loose the dogs of war on the 13th.
Now, what do you mean by that?
He gives them no hazards, just to push the Confederates. And their main objective, rather than capturing strategic cities, their object now is
To encounter the army and
to destroy Johnston's army.
And in the Civil War tactics, can you is there a battle that illustrates this earlier or anything that so we can help try to figure out what Sherman was doing?
Well, again, this is one of those rare occasions, and pretty much like Sherman's campaign all through the South, without a really major force like infantry, like you would think of Civil War tactics like Gettysburg or Chancellorsville or a battle like that, where the infantry is engaged and the artillery is engaged. Most of his entire campaign is a cavalry fight, especially once he leaves Atlanta, goes to Savannah on up to Raleigh. His armies, his infantry is marching unopposed. There's no major forces except at the Battle of Bentonville.
In other words, I'm trying to get a modern-day analogy now. This is not what Sherman was after in destroying his army, but what he was doing before was to sweep through and destroy the capability of the Confederate economy to support the army. It might be appropriate. It's an analogy to the swift capture of Iraq by the American forces, just driving past opposition and taking control of various geographical points.
Right. And just as modern warfare today, this cavalry would sort of act as a shield around Sherman's main infantry column. They would protect the wagon trains. They would be the scouts, the eyes and ears of the army. And they would sort of protect these main columns from falling into any traps the Confederates might lay for them. So just as, you know, the tanks rolling across the Iraqi desert, they would have scout cars out in front.
And were the Confederates, in this earlier Sherman's advance from Atlanta to Savannah and then up through the Carolinas, what was the Confederate strategy to resist Sherman?
Again, there wasn't very much, just because the Confederacy made a major blunder. After the fall of Atlanta, the Army of the Tennessee, which was left, decided to invade Tennessee. So they went north, Sherman went east.
They just split apart and went
opposite
directions.
Other people. And the only force that was left to try and stop Sherman or at least harass his movements are the same soldiers who were fighting outside Chapel Hill. They are shadowing Sherman's army as they move, harassing them, killing a lot of the foragers who go out for food. And they have been fighting for so long against Sherman's column. I think it might be one of the most campaigns with the longest days of sustained combat on either side.
Well, again, we're going to come back to this Chapel Hill encounter. But first, Ernest Dollar, let's take a quick break. I'm D.G. Martin. It's Who's Talking Today. I'm talking to Ernest Dollar, who's the executive director of the Orange County Historical Museum. We're talking about the last battle of the Civil War. Well, maybe the last. Well, one of the last battles of the Civil War right here in Chapel Hill. And he and I will be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking Today. I'm D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Ernest Dollar. Ernest Dollar is the retiring executive director of the Orange County Historical Museum. And one of his final this isn't fair to say. One of the final pieces of his service will be this weekend at a seminar up in Hillsborough sponsored by the museum. And you got do you have co-sponsor? Y'all just doing this by yourselves? This is a – which we'll talk about Orange County's role in the Civil War. And this will be – is this Saturday?
Mm-hmm.
Saturday from 12 noon to 4. I think you're going to charge $5 admission. You'll sure get your money's worth.
He'll be at the old courthouse.
At the old courthouse in Hillsborough with speakers such as our friend Freddie Kiger, world-renowned expert on the Civil War and world-renowned – radio personality here on WCHL.
And it's his birthday.
But and you've got yourself. You'll be talking about some of the same things we're talking about now, about the very end of the war here in Orange County and what was Orange County over in at Bennett Place. Is it Jacqueline Glass Campbell will be talking about women and African Americans and their response to Sherman's, this sweep that we're talking about. Very big bargain at $5. I know some people are paying hundreds of dollars to listen to Freddie Kiger, and your commentary, Ernest, is priceless. You've helped us put this Civil War into the Civil War in perspective. We're kind of getting the idea of what Sherman's body of troops looks like with cavalry and very and protected infantry destroying as they go along. And now they're meeting a larger body that they have met in North Carolina, a larger body of Confederate forces who are creating a little bit of a problem for them in terms of if they can't stop them, they're at least slow. They've at least slowed Sherman down.
Oh yeah.
And you mentioned to us earlier that Sherman had given the order, okay, we're tired of this. We're going to just destroy this army. And that order went out about this time in April of 1865. As looking back at it, we know that the war was about to come to an end. Well, now, what again, set us up towards this battle, these skirmishes in Chapel Hill.
The 13th, Sherman's cavalry comes in, takes over the Capitol, cuts down the Confederate flag flying over the Capitol.
And takes our Bill of Rights.
Exactly. Somebody takes it. And the Confederates move just out of town. And again, it's this cavalry who is actually acting as a rear guard for Johnston's soldiers. They're going to contest the road to try and slow down.
Ernest, let me interrupt you again. If the cavalry takes over Raleigh, where is Sherman's infantry? Are they following up behind fairly quickly to take over occupation rules? Mm-hmm. And how quickly does that take place?
I would say the next couple of days. Most of his army is deployed on the western side of Raleigh, like Blue Ridge Road, the fairgrounds, all in a semicircle. Mm.
A defensive. Sherman takes up a – is that right? And where are the Confederates now?
They're moving Hillsborough, Chapel Hill. They've moved through. So they've got about a 2 days march ahead of Sherman's main columns.
And what is going on in the area between these two bodies of forces?
Again, once the Confederates are not really expecting the Federals to really follow them as doggedly as what happens. The Federals push out and totally rout the Confederates on the morning of April 13th. And at a small skirmish that was out of town at that time, which is where Electric Company Mall is and Pogue and Gardner Street, which was considered out of town at the time. And it's basically a running battle from here through Cary, all toward Morrisville.
And how do you characterize it? Is it just that the Union forces are marching forward, Confederates are taking a few shots at them and then running? Is that sort of what it's like?
Well, again, Sherman's cavalry commander, General Judson Kilpatrick, he was nicknamed Kill Cavalry, and Sherman called him one damned hell of a fool, but this is the kind of guy he wanted as cavalry commander. So he would line up a lot of these large body of mounted soldiers and just charge headlong into the enemy. You see them fighting a lot with sabers, pistols, close-range shotguns. And you see a new weapon appear on the battlefield, the Spencer repeating carbine, which is, they could take seven shots loaded with a metallic cartridge, which proved to be a deadly warfare. And that's one of the weapons that we know were used at New Hope Creek. So you see these 3,000 or 4,000 men on each side. The Federals are pushing the Confederates right
now, out of
the
again, heart. Not 3,000 or 4,000 cavalry?
Yeah.
Wow.
Each side at this point, you had the combined commands of General Wade Hampton, who had just been shifted down from the Army of Northern Virginia with his cavalry, and Joseph Wheeler, who had been pretty much opposing Sherman all through the South, had combined their commands, about 4,500, and the Federal cavalry is about the same number. So you see desperate dispatches sent to Wade Hampton from Wheeler saying, I am compelled to halt my entire command and charge headlong to the advancing Federals to try and buy time for the Confederate infantry to escape. Now, in the case of Morrisville, all these little train stops moving west of Raleigh were depots. The scene on April 12th in Raleigh must have been a scene of chaos. The Confederate infantry is moving. People are terrified that Raleigh will suffer the same fate as Columbia, which was pretty much burned to the ground, either by Sherman's men or retreating Confederates. So they're terrified. So the Confederate government is moving all of these boxcars of supplies to all these little depots along the way, like Morrisville, Page's Station, which Cary's used to be called. And they were trying to save these supplies. So they would grab boxcars, pull them out, decouple the cars, send them back to Raleigh, and sort of leapfrog these supplies out. So moving along the railroad, Kilpatrick captures all of these prizes for the day to add another laurel to his crown.
he captures all the supplies, or much of the supplies that the Confederates were trying to move out. And today we would think of just hauling it by truck or something like that. The only way to move substantial amounts of supplies in was by railroad. So you could only do that as long as you controlled
right.
railroad tracks. But I guess what I'm having a hard time picturing is how the Confederates were moving supplies out of Raleigh when the Federals had already captured Raleigh.
Well, this will be on the day before April 2nd. As one of the last things the Confederates do is they set fire to the depot before they leave. So when the Federals approach, like, you can imagine a large black plume of smoke bellowing up. So they, on the preceding days, they had pretty good warning that Sherman was on his way. So they're trying to evacuate all the wounded out of Pettigrew Hospital in Raleigh and all the depot with tons and tons of supplies.
Wow. So this gets us maybe to Morrisville. Is mm-hmm. that – what's kind of – give us the lay of the land before this Morrisville battle.
Morrisville is sort of in a valley as you're driving on Highway 54 going – and it's right outside the Research Triangle, which is kind of having a Civil War battle in the heart of the triangle. I'm not
right.
sure many people know about. But again, as the situation unfolds – the Federal cavalry catches up with sort of the main body of the Confederate cavalry. As they approach the bluffs to Morrisville, the Federals see this long train trying to pull out of this valley. And it's not making much time because it's got all these heavy cars of supplies and wounded. And it's kind of chugging up these hills. So again, Kilpatrick sees an opportunity to really capture this entire train along with this engine, which is a scarce commodity in the Confederacy for 1865.
So this train, this is the battle for the train rather than the battle for Morrisville. Mm-hmm. And it's chugging westward towards, where would it be? Towards the Durham Station.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kilpatrick gets out his binoculars and he sees this train. He says, I want it.
Exactly.
And sends out a whole bunch of cavalry to get it. What is that?
What he does is he deploys his artillery above the town and they start shelling the town. Now, these guys were soldiers who had been in D.C. most of the time guarding the Capitol. And once the threat is gone, they're shifted down to support Sherman and his campaign. So these guys are green as they can be. And they were one unit in particular was the 23rd New York Light Artillery, which was a rocket battery before. You know, you don't think of Civil War like shooting rockets. Well, these things are pretty ineffective, but they were cavalry weapons that would scare the horses. So they take away these guys' bottle rockets and give them these cannons. And so they start are horse artillerymen and start shelling the town. Kilpatrick pulls up three regiments of cavalry, which make a mad dash for the train.
How many horses and men in a regiment? Is that a few hundred?
About this time, you're probably looking at about 500 men who are there and ready for service because
wow.
you had so many that – their horses had been shot or died. So a lot of them were dismounted. But I would say a safe number would be about 500 per regiment.
Wow. Okay. So this is a lot of horses and a lot of men.
There's a lot of stuff flying in the air.
So there's a big artillery. Kilpatrick has horse artillery mm-hmm. that is light artillery, I guess, that can be pulled along speedily. But nevertheless, sends a very heavy artillery barrage down on Morrisville where he thinks the Confederate troops are, I guess. Is
yeah.
that
The Confederates are all kind of spread out, I guess, around the depot, hiding behind corn cribs, barns, anything they can seek shelter. These 3-inch shells start coming lobbing in from the Federal artillery, what kind of gives the cover for this charge to start taking shape.
So do we have any idea about the tactics Kilpatrick, the Federal cavalry commander, used? Did he just send them headlong into Morrisville?
That's pretty much what I can decipher from the records, that he just lined up three units and just said – he sounded the charge on the bugle, and they made a mad dash for the depot to catch this train. The Confederates, who had been unsuccessful all day long in stopping Kilpatrick, finally have a chance to put enough firepower in them, and they get within about 150 yards of the depot before they're compelled to withdraw. So Wheeler makes a command decision. He looks at this train, which is not making any ground fast. He makes a decision to...
Wheeler is the Confederate cavalry commander.
Right. He uncouples the cars of supplies, allowing for the cars full of the wounded to escape.
Wow. And so that's the result. Kilpatrick has what he wants, which is the supplies, and Wheeler has the, I guess he feels good about having rescued his wounded from capture and probably certain, well, not such a good time in federal hands probably at this point.
Right. So this ends the fighting on the 13th.
Let me just back up. What did Wheeler have at his command? What kind of troops? Did he have equivalent forces to Kilpatrick's three regiments of cavalry?
I don't know. The Confederate records on the Battle of Mooresville are strangely not available. I haven't found any. Most of what we know comes from diaries written by federal soldiers who were at the battle.
Well,
and they leave a neat record of how the battle
exactly
unfolded.
What happened. Well, gosh, it's well past time for us to take a break. I apologize, but I've gotten so involved in this Battle of Morrisville that I risk not having enough time to pay attention to the Battle of the New Hope Creek Battles. What do you call this? The Battles of Chapel Hill? Can we do that?
Yeah, that works.
Whatever it is. Ernest Dollar and I are talking about the end of the Civil War here in Orange County, and he and I will be right back after this short break. Well, welcome back to Who's Talking Today. I'm D.G. Martin, and my guest is Ernest Dollar, the Executive Director of the Orange County Historical Museum, and also one of the speakers in the upcoming symposium on the role of Orange County in the Civil War. Ernest will be one of the speakers. Freddie Kiger will be another, and Jacqueline Glass Campbell will also talk. 12 noon to 4 o'clock. Admission is just $5 in the Old County Courthouse in Hillsborough. Ernest, that's a bargain. But we're getting some of this even for less. This description of the campaign from Raleigh to Chapel Hill with Sherman chasing Johnson's forces, and you're pointing out that it's really a battle between the cavalry, at this point, the cavalry commanders. Is it Colonel or General Kilpatrick?
General Kilpatrick.
General Kilpatrick commanding cavalry forces, and General Wade Hampton and General Wheeler,
Joseph Wheeler, yeah.
Commanding cavalry forces for the Confederacy, fighting it out right here between Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Just describe the Battle of Morrisville. What happens after the Battle of Morrisville?
Well, both sides kind of settle down and lick their wounds for the day.
This is April the 13th.
Mm-hmm. The next day, not much goes on. You see... Well, to set up, to really lay the ground plans for New Hope Creek, we have to revisit the fact that Johnston split his army here, his main infantry, to move faster away from Sherman's army. So, again, two corps go north through Durham Station to Hillsborough, and one goes west through Carpenter, Chapel Hill, and on up into Hillsborough to meet the army again. To cover this, Sherman does the same thing. He splits his cavalry force. Kilpatrick, along with two brigades, goes north to Durham Station to fight their way north. One brigade under General Smith Atkins follows the western path. Again, they don't want to push the Confederates too hard on this western path because they're trying to keep up the feint that get Johnston to believe that Sherman is following him on this direct arc along the railroad, when in fact he's trying to swoop down and come up underneath Johnston and catch him in Charlotte. The morning of the 14th dawns, the two federal wings spread out, and they basically, the western wing, commanded by Atkins, which we're going to really focus on, fights its way to the Carpenter area. Again, Wheeler's Confederate cavalry are compelled to halt their entire command and charge headlong into the advancing Federals right around the
Just
Carpenter.
Just to slow them down.
Yeah.
Put Carpenter in perspective for us.
I guess if we go down Highway 55, there's a wonderful old-timey, for lack of a better term, store in Carpenter. It's a little railroad community which popped up, I guess, in the 1880s. But in the 1860s, this was just on the main route.
On the railroad between Raleigh and Durham,
right,
between Cary and Durham.
The route that this western branch follows would have been the main route that you would have traveled in antebellum North Carolina to get from Chapel Hill to the Capitol. So this was like the I-40 of its day.
And it was just a little road stop, but this is where the Federals were assembling?
Where the Federals had chased the Confederates until the Confederates said, okay, enough is enough. We're gonna
we'll camp here. We'll wait for them here.
We're gonna pitch into you, and they had a large skirmish there.
And what is we call this the carpenter
again? Looking at this time period, so little is written on it that no one. These little battles and skirmishes are so overlooked, and that's why New Hope Creek has been buried for mm-hmm. so long that no one has really taken a close look at the movements of the armies during this last.
Well, all right. After this skirmish is it at Carpenter, mm-hmm. what happens then? This is the 14th. Is this still the 14th?
Mm-hmm. The Federals stop. They pull back a couple of miles to Mooresville, and on the midnight, a very strange messenger arrives into Federal lines in Mooresville. A Confederate captain has a truce, had a white flag, and enters Kilpatrick's lines with a note from General Johnston asking Sherman about the possibility of meeting for an armistice.
Well, you've gotten my curiosity piqued, and I bet you some of those of you who are listening are wondering really what happened. We know a whole lot more, Ernest, thanks to your description of these last encounters in the Civil War here in Orange County. And want to know more. And for those who would like to know more, there's a great opportunity at the Civil War Symposium sponsored by the Orange County Historical Museum in Hillsborough on this Saturday from 12 noon to 4 p.m. And Ernest, is there a telephone number or something you can give for people who would just like to know more about this?
Yeah, they can call the museum at area code 919-732-2201, and we'll give you everything you need to know.
Great. Well, thanks again for taking time to visit with us. This has been so interesting, and I look forward to learning more.
Well, thanks for having me.
Good luck in your new ventures.
Thanks.
Thanks to all of y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin. It's Who's Talking Today. My guest has been Ernest Dollar, Executive Director of the Orange County Historical Museum.